This is the Cullinane and Green Report. Today, our special guest is Irv Rain.
Welcome to the Cullinane and Green Report. I'm Joe Cullinane.
And I'm Roger Green. Our special guest today is Irv Rain, Ph.D., an internationally known expert in public communication and popular culture, and a professor of communication studies at Northwestern University's School of Communication. Irv is a communication advisor to numerous highly visible places, organizations, and individuals. He has authored 12 books, including High Visibility, A Groundbreaking Study of Image Making, and most recently, The Elusive Fan, Reinventing Sports in a Crowded Marketplace, a penetrating reappraisal of the sports industry and its emerging technologies. He also serves on Major Baseball's Commissioner's Initiative for the 21st Century and is a member of the Advisory Board for Northwestern University's Master of Arts in Sports Administration.
Irv, welcome to the Cullinane and Green Report.
Pleasure to be on, Joe.
Now, in the spirit of full disclosure, I must inform our listeners that Irv was my professor at Northwestern and the advisor on my master's project. So, and that was just a couple years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. It seems like a lot longer, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You're a good student, though, Joe.
So well, I appreciate that, Irv.
You should, Joe.
Anyway, in addition to teaching at Northwestern, you've been quite busy writing. Tell us about your new book, The Elusive Fan.
It was kind of based on a long history of being involved in sports. I originally, was very active in sports, and I played sports all my young life, went to college on a football scholarship, coached for a couple of years in high school, and then went back and got a PhD and became a university professor for a long period of time. And all the time, I had this notion that I could apply the communication and marketing experience that I had to sports. And as I looked at the sports world, I looked at, the kinds of ways they looked at it, I felt that we could give it a perspective that simply didn't exist. And what really fueled this was that we feel that of all the activities, whether it's the car business or show business or whatever, nothing is more competitive and fragmented than sports.
Right.
And this was a great, great place to look at how technology, how the new marketing paradigms, how the just the brutal, information battle is being conducted. So that's the elusive fan. I mean, it's basically saying, here's an incredibly difficult market that has been impacted by competition and technology, and here's how you can reinvent it. Here's how you can make this work. So that's how we got to it.
What are some of the techniques that you might suggest to our listeners that they could learn about marketing from reading The Elusive Fan?
Well, we do a number of things, and it's really important, I think, to understand that channel distribution, the pipelines have changed dramatically in sports. And, of course, if you're in any business related to, trying to market or retail anything, that's true. So, for example, one of the major issues that we deal with is that the traditional channels, such as ESPN, CBS, NBC, CNN, whatever, are beginning to lose share to other players. So, for example, Major League Baseball has gone into the streaming business and is arguably one of the largest streamers in the world.
That's right.
Selling their product. The NBA has their own global channel. The National Football League, which is like the other two leagues all over the world, basically now is going to this year, for the first time, televise on their own channel 8 of their games. And this is the kind of thing we're seeing. For example, the NFL had a draft, their football draft, for the first time this year. They actually ran the draft on their own network. And also ESPN did it too. So what we're seeing is, whether it's extreme sports or whatever else, we're seeing them forced to develop not only their own content and then begin selling it in some way, marketing it in some way, in very unconventional, untraditional ways. So that's a major, major issue, which means that for the sports industry, which used to kind of wholesale out their products, that is, they'd say, okay, well, the newspapers, television people, they'll write the stories. Now they're doing the stories. or at least they're in competition with the very networks that they used to work with. So you're seeing a real radical shift.
They're kind of becoming vertically integrated.
Yeah, right. And of course, with that means that the sports, just like the car business or anybody else, finds themselves having to develop content. And when I say content, it's a lot different from, you know, running a PR piece and then turning it over to the media, right, and letting them work it. Now they really have to make the argument, develop the strategy, and reach the fan.
Right.
So it's really a tremendous change in the way that the industry is operating. And I must say, it's only been the last 2 or 3 years.
So it's further blurring the line between sports and entertainment.
Well, yeah, I don't think there is a line.
You're probably right.
I've
watched wrestling for a long time, too.
Yeah. Well, you know, wrestling, you know, they wrote the playbook on this.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, we're going back to the 40s and Gorgeous George. In fact, we have an interesting case on Gorgeous George.
Right, I saw that. Yeah.
I don't know if you both remember Gorgeous George.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah.
But he was this guy from a small town in the Midwest of the United States. His name was George Wagner, and he was kind of a overweight wrestler. And he wrestled around, but he was mediocre. And what he did was he developed this this kind of blonde Adonis sort of quasi-gay character. But he wasn't gay, but he was sort of played this on. He threw bobby pins into the audience when he showed up. Had perfume that he would spray into the audience.
He was way ahead of his time.
Yeah, we're talking 1949, the beginning of television in the United States. People went crazy. And in lots of ways, There's a person who really established, you know, the relationship between entertainment and sports, that now you've seen worldwide wrestling. And even someone like the Harlem Globetrotters, which we have another case of, which, you know, is all over the world.
Yeah.
But they married entertainment and sports probably before anybody did, really, in a realistic way. And this is late 20s, 1930s in the United States, and then all over the world, in the 50s and 60s and 70s and on.
Irv, I have to bring up the book High Visibility. I think it's one of the best marketing and communication books ever written. I've used it in classes I've taught. I know you have a new edition out. Tell us a little bit about High Visibility and the impact it's had.
We first wrote this book. It was first published in 1987, the first edition. And we started working in 1984, believe it or not. That's 22 years ago.
Wow.
And at the time, we coined the term high visibility to describe something other than celebrity and something other than fame. And when we first wrote the book, we had a lot of feedback back from people saying, hey, you know, you're glorifying people. You know, this is something you shouldn't be, you know, marketing people like you're marketing products. Now, that had a really big impact back then in the 80s because that just wasn't accepted. Then we did another version in 97, and by that time, 1997, it was no longer an issue. The new book in 06, that we just came out in January, we're basically applying the latest technology, the latest segmentation strategies, which have really changed the way people are, you know, are viewed today in our society. So, for example, you see the use of websites, which really didn't really exist so much, you know, even 10 years ago. It was really virtually impossible. Websites have made it easier to find people, but harder to engage them. That is, there's so many of them out there. So it's not so expensive, I mean, really, to reach people, whether it's a Facebook or Friendster or something like that. But it's difficult to engage. In other words, it's like the universe, you know, for well-knownness has expanded like 100 million times.
Right.
You know, it's just like, you know, anybody can become well-known if they can engage the technology, right, and have some kind of content that interests people. And so in that sense, it's turned, you know, visibility on its head. So, for example, you now have shows like American Idol and things of that nature, which are kind of based on the fan driving the message. Whereas before, because of restricted technology and it cost so much money to put on a show, or, you know, what was a camera, $100,000 or $200,000,
right,
or whatever it was, Now it's nothing. It's virtually nothing, meaning that fans can now participate, you know, in making decisions as to who's going to be well-known, which is something that never really existed before, which means that if you're looking at a market from a segmentation point of view, instead of perhaps going to CAA and some of the big agencies, right, or the entertainment lawyers or the sports agents or whatever it is, you appeal directly to the fans themselves. I think that's a real sea change in the way technology has affected visibility.
Irv, Andy Warhol made a famous quote about everyone getting their 10 minutes of fame.
It was 15, wasn't it?
Yeah, 15. Well, now we measure it in bytes, I think, and bits. And in the business world, 15 minutes of fame isn't going to do you that much good anyway. You know, our podcast really is focused on the intersection of technology and business development. How would you suggest, and you've talked about the web a little bit, people raising their visibility using the Internet in an effective way from a business perspective?
I go back to what I said earlier in the podcast about this whole notion of technology and content. What I find is that the pipelines are there and becoming cheaper and more easily attained. But what's lacking is argument and strategy. And what you have is a lot of, you know, platitudes, people saying, oh, you know, using terminology that becomes commonplace. But to make a tight, powerful argument with good support that understands the nature of the audience, how important audience analysis is. In fact, given what's going on in business and technology today, I would say audience analysis is absolutely critical and missing. And let me tell you what I mean. It's not just segmentation. Segmentation, you know, is finding those audiences that you feel you want to reach and are perhaps reachable. But audience analysis is understanding who your audience is and what makes them believe in something, you know, what their gender is, how they feel about, I mean, all that sort of thing, and being able then to apply it to your product. That's what's missing. Because as technology becomes more widely used, we really don't see the buyer. In fact, we're less inclined to see the buyer, right? We've moved, 100 years from face-to-face to podcasts, right, and websites and everything where you say, okay, I'm going to put together this technological instrument, right, this pipeline with the following content, and you really don't see that person. And the feedback is pretty fragmented. You may not see the person, or you may get a line, you may get sales or whatever it happens to be, but it's pretty abstract, and therefore you need to be very good at the issue of audience analysis. So I'd say understanding that and understanding the strategies that can be used to reach those audiences is absolutely critical.
Do you see any conflict between that those statements and the issues about privacy that we're getting on the Internet today?
You know, that's an interesting issue. I mean, you're talking about the kinds of tracking devices that various organizations use to infiltrate audiences, right?
Right, yeah, because it's so hard to know who's there without some sort of, tracking mechanism, as you say.
Yeah, right. And I guess you bring up a very interesting point and something that perhaps I don't think about much, because I think about audience analysis in its broadest sense of researching and understanding and even reaching a deeper level of understanding of what motivates people.
Right.
But I don't think there's any question that that there's a fine line in that. I mean, I don't like to be traced myself.
Right. You know? Who does? Right.
The other issue that I was going to mention that is critical, that we spend a lot of time in the elusive fan on and do touch on in high visibility, is the notion of marketing to youth. I don't know how much you discussed this in your broadcast, but we find that this is the most difficult audience to reach, because this is the audience that's driven by technology the most. Video games, cell phones, MySpace, YouTube, all that sort of thing.
Right.
And trying to find the language and channels to interact with this audience is extremely difficult, especially since they move around so much. And for example, they might be cued into 8 different technological instruments in one day. and trying to get their attention and engage them is a very, very big challenge for industry of all sorts.
And it tends to change quite often, too.
Oh, yeah, it changes. You know, one of the examples we have in the Elusive Fan is called 1X to 3X through 45, which is a high school football team in the United States of 50 years ago. And the point of the whole case is to demonstrate how technology has changed in reaching youth. Back then, when kids would play football in the fall, basketball in the winter, baseball in the spring, you knew as a marketer that in 20 years, that's what they would be watching, major league professional sports in those areas.
Right.
That's simply not true with youth anymore. I mean, you don't know what they're going to be doing in 20 years.
That's very true.
It's very true, and I think that's true of all industry trends, isn't it? I mean, you take the car business. What are those people going to want to buy in 20 years? what are they going to want in 20 years?
Isn't another issue that they depend very much on their peer group, that word-of-mouth marketing is critical to them? In other words, they won't listen to commercials or view commercials, but they'll send out an instant message to five of their friends about products, and that's how the millennials buy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true to some extent, certainly more so than when we were kids, because we couldn't pick up the cell phone for 2 cents a minute, right?
Right.
I mean, it was $5 a minute or whatever it is to call somebody in Miami. So that's true. But you look at the buying patterns, and I have to believe that certain kinds of commercials, certain kinds of appeals work at even what we might call a semi-mass level. And trying to strike those chords is really important still. And if I were, I look at it from an industry point of view, a business point of view, I'm asking myself, how am I going to spend those dollars to reach these people, even though I know that there's a lot of this word-of-mouth business, because I ultimately want to stimulate that, right?
Right.
I mean, somebody's got to initiate among those kids, and therefore my task is to get that initiator.
Right. Reach the influencer.
Right.
Right. Right.
So switching gears a little bit, Irv, you're one of the leading experts in public communication in the world. What do you suggest for someone now who is doing public communication? Let's say they're doing a presentation at a company meeting or something like that. What would your suggestion be for the best way to present using, technology and media?
I'm glad you brought up that question, because I just did something yesterday. It was a keynote speech to a large insurance company on their brand.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a luncheon speech. There were 15 people in the room, and it was at a fancy hotel, and they were eating while I was speaking. There was no speech after you eat. It was while they're eating.
Right.
And, of course, I didn't get to eat. But the fact is that I had to look at all the possibilities here. You ask yourself, what are the possibilities? What is the best way to reach those people? And I did something very non-technical in this particular case, which I think I want to talk about adapting to the audience in this case, because it goes back to what we talked about earlier about audience adaptation. I used the old-fashioned flip chart.
Great.
And I put it right kind of like the center of the eating area, because I was determined to work off them. And I wanted the animation of my working back to the flip chart, crossing things out, being energetic, that sort of thing. And it worked. It worked better than anything I could have done. I mean, if I used video or a PowerPoint, it would not have worked in that situation. After all, they had to see their food.
Right, right.
Exactly.
They had to see their food, and I wanted them to feel free and talk to me. Now, if I was in a larger environment, it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had 150 people in the room, my choices would have been far different. I would not have used that flip chart. They couldn't have seen it. It was not slick enough for the larger audience. And probably what I would have done there is used a video that I probably would have developed in my lab, which would have anticipated their questions, and I probably would have worked off that, turning it on and off. But I like video, and I find that video gets a good response from larger audiences. In my case, better than PowerPoint. Because, I can write on the video, but it's a faster picture. I do believe eventually they'll meld, And, you know, there'll be a very powerful interaction between the two. But I still like video better than PowerPoint for larger audiences.
Well, it's interesting you brought that up because Al Gore's new movie, what's the name of the movie, Raj?
An Inconvenient Truth.
An Inconvenient Truth is actually based on
it.
Did you see it? It's based on a keynote, like, you know, Apple's PowerPoint is the whole movie. And now, wasn't Al Gore one of your students at Harvard?
Yeah, he was. He was in my public speaking class. Got an A. But not that presentation.
But I mean, the idea is that they actually took this PowerPoint slide and made a movie out of it. So there's sort of the convergence keynote.
I would not want to, you know, of course, I didn't see all of Gore's presentation. And, you know, when you see it on the film, what they're spilling, you know, a piece of it or just showing a 3-minute piece of it.
Actually, they built the whole thing in Keynote, which is the Apple presentation software, including the film clips. Everything was embedded in Keynote.
Well, that's interesting.
And then they transferred the Keynote to 35mm film.
My objection is to bad PowerPoint. Not to diss your presentation to me, Joe, at that time. But but the fact is, generally speaking, it's misuse of PowerPoint that I object to. They pack it on. I mean, on one hand, they put too many points on it, which is a killer. You know, it's like a mission statement that's 2 pages. You know, who wants to read a 2-page mission statement?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's the same way. And you're looking at it, and you can't read it all, and it goes to the next point, and nothing gets embedded in your mind. It's like no one makes a choice. And on top of that, the person uses it as a cheat outline.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have 5 points up there. He or she reads the 5 points, right?
Right.
I mean, where are you going with that? It becomes like looking at someone's outline. Now, what you're talking about, Al Gore, that's a very sophisticated piece of work, right? With a lot of animation, a lot of color, a lot of variation. So one would argue that when video and animation and PowerPoint merge in a very creative, very difficult sometimes presentation, it can be really effective and exciting.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I guess what's really disgusting here is that getting back to the main point, you know, one has to work on content no matter what the technology is.
Absolutely.
If the content's bad, the presentation's going to be bad no matter how sophisticated your technology is. And I think that's a big flaw in the way people perceive the way they're going to do their presentations. They use the technology as a crutch.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think it gets back to your previous point about analyzing your audience, too, knowing what's going to work for that specific audience at that time, at that place. And I think that's critical. And so, in the case you described, you use the flip chart. But I think that's a key factor.
Yeah, I think that if you've got the content and you understand the audience and you look at, for example, how large your audience is, what their needs are, you know, if they're eating and if you can't turn the lights down too much, there's things that you can use that are really, I guess you would call low tech, that can be very effective.
Right.
I think one should ask the question, what's best for this audience? And particularly concentrate on the relationship between getting your content across and really impacting that audience. Now, Gore, we're talking about Al Gore, and that your listeners have watched that film. I thought that there were some missing pieces in that film, you know, particularly the way they tried to present Gore as a person. I mean, I think the audience started to think, well, is this about the environment or about his running for president?
Right, right.
Interesting.
And I think that, you know, and that's a content issue here, right, and choice issue that really transcends the choice of presentation or technology.
Right. Interesting points. Can I just ask a little digression here a little bit? Is the public speaking book still in print? That was
no.
A great little book.
No. I've always enjoyed working with that material, and I learned a lot. You know, it's like just when I was coaching in high school, you know, this all adds up to what kind of presenter, communicator you're going to be. I mean, in the end, you know, no matter what theories you learn or concepts you learn, it's really about, you know, being able to apply it to your experiences. So I've been able to do that. You know, I feel even my consulting experiences have really impacted my writing greatly.
Irv, speaking of your consulting practice, tell us a little bit about the services that you provide and if you would, even some of the clients you've worked with.
I've had some interesting experiences. I worked for NASA for 17 years. Now, there's an interesting, you know, interplay of content and technology.
Yes.
And those years were in 1984 to 2001, basically. Some really volatile years for NASA. And my job there was basically to work only with the astronauts and their communication skills. And what I did there was I put together a program in which we practiced not only on the ground, their press conferences, but their press conferences, their teaching in space, in the air. And what we did was we took a shuttle that was, on the ground, obviously, and we practiced the questions, and then we go into a room and work on it. And I learned a lot about audiences, and I hope they did too, but a typical astronaut crew might have 10 or 11 different audiences to deal with, ranging from Congress to the local media, to international media,
right,
to scientists, to kids in high school or grade school who are being downloaded information, all those sorts of things. So you really see in a situation like that the interplay of technology and audience analysis and content. And I thought we did a pretty good job of communicating the NASA message during that period. I think right now, I think momentum obviously has been blunted, but that was one set of circumstances. I also should add that one of the interesting aspects of NASA was how antiquated some of the technology was.
Right.
I mean, like, for example, their computers that they used on shuttles and stuff was really old. I mean, it was really an interesting kind of situation. I mean, they had the best and the worst.
Right.
And, you know, you can blame that on the government and whatever happens to be, but it was an interesting sort of thing, and they were doing, you know, really cutting-edge work. But I think it tells you, I'll tell you an interesting insight of the NASA experience. It was fascinating to me because, you know, you go up in the air, you're 200 miles up in the air, you got six people, and the questions come from the ground. You know, the Houston Post, New York Times. Someone says, "I'm Joe Blow, New York Times." You can't see the person. You know, they're down there somewhere. They're on Earth, and you're way up in the sky. You can't read their expression. You may not even have met the person. And now you've got 11 different audiences to communicate with.
Oh, boy.
And so I learned a lot.
It's not unlike podcasting, actually.
Yeah, right. I mean, but it was a precursor. But we're talking about, you know, 15, 20 years ago. It was a precursor to what's going on now. And I guess what I'm saying is I really learned audience analysis under those circumstances. So, for example, when you went over Japan, if there's a Japan astronaut on board, you know, it was a big event. And there's a whole special set of circumstances that surrounded that. And one had to communicate with it. Or, for example, if there was something going on Earth that was really important, a political issue, a war, or whatever it is, those people up in that capsule sealed in there had to answer those questions. So it's an interesting set of circumstances that I felt that really helped me work with high visibility and the elusive fan in terms of technology.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, sort of, you know, it's like you're in the middle of something and you're faced with it, and therefore you either adapt to it or you're just going to give in and do the old thing again. Another client I had was Richard Daley, who is now the mayor of Chicago. And I was with Daley for 7 years. There's another interesting set of circumstances where, you know, you're moving from face-to-face, which is still operating, but to television, internet, websites, all these sorts of things in political communication. With NASA, you're talking about science and bringing that to the public. Here you're talking about politics, bringing it to the public, both heavily technology-driven. And, you know, trying to make someone like Daley, who really is given his father, who was mayor of the city, and given the image of the Daleys, you know, appear contemporary and fresh, given the new technologies, was always a task, you know, and a challenge.
Do you still work with politicians? Because you used to do quite a bit of
work. No, I don't. Well, I haven't done anything for about 3 years. Right now, I'm a consultant for Major League Baseball. and that's one of my primary clients. And of course, that's another interesting business, interesting sport, and very involved in technology. You know, I talked about how Major League Baseball is now one of the principal streamers of information all over the world. Who would ever think of something like that?
Yeah, really.
Really, it's just amazing. But now, trying to reach all the markets and with all the fragmentation going on, you know, in competition with soccer, basketball, even paintball. You know, paintball in the United States has 10 million participants and another 2 million worldwide. I mean, that didn't exist 20, yeah. 30 years ago in terms of competition.
I saw dodgeball on ESPN the other day.
Yeah. Well, dodgeball has 300,000 certified members of the Dodgeball Association.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, you know, playing dodgeball. I mean, who would have thought that, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, but Major League Baseball is competing with those dodgeball people, the paintball people, the people the shopping mall people, the theater people, the film people, you name it. Everybody's in this incredible, intense competition, and we've only been in it for 2, 3, 4 years. And you go back 2, 3, 4 years, and you start reading and looking at what was going on. People were talking about divergence, convergence.
Right.
So no one knew what the hell they talked about in theoretical terms, right?
Right? Yeah.
Now it's here, and it means competition is ferocious.
So what are you doing specifically for Major League Baseball?
Well, right now I'm working on a project on youth and baseball.
Okay.
Like all sports, all activities, everybody's trying to figure out what's the best way to reach that youth market. I mean, that's a big challenge. I mean, you think about the two biggest challenges in the marketplace today. Youth is number one to me. And the second, we are the baby boomers, right?
Yeah.
Right. You know, because they're so huge. It's such a huge market. But the youth market, you know, is just not responding to the traditional messages that historically we talked about. And since kids don't play all the traditional sports the way they did, you know, it's kind of a mad scramble to get these people when they're adults and into professional sports. Soccer, right, for example, you know, does very well worldwide, the premier sport worldwide, no question. But in the United States, even though there's a strong kid participation, there's just not much interest, at least at this point, at the professional level. And so they're trying to, you know, they're trying to adapt to that. So I think all sports, all entertainment, all retail businesses are trying to figure out how to reach this marketplace, and that's really what we're trying to do.
Yeah, Irv, on a related topic, there was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, which they headlined as, quote, the moguls of new media, which are precisely the things you're talking about right now. And they discussed the unbelievable popularity and visibility that some of these new media are achieving for, really, you would describe it as just plain ordinary people. An example was one young woman on MySpace has literally logged 1 million online friends. And and there was a podcaster who has literally 300,000 listeners for each podcast. And yet neither of these people have managed to monetize this or convert it into some sort of career. While a few have, most have not. In fact, that seems to be one of the other characteristics. Do you think this is sort of an aberration on the timeline, or is this just another example that not all visibility necessarily leads to great wealth?
You know, this reminds me, you know, of the car business in 1910, 1915. If you go back to that business, you'd see that there were hundreds of manufacturers of cars.
That's right.
Cars that we mostly have forgotten, and which I'd love to own, some of those cars. You know, whether
right,
Crosley or Hubmobile, all those cars, you know, that there's just tons of these people. LaSalle. And I think we're in that kind of stage now where it's easy to find these people. I mean, people are sampling lots of people. But no one has consolidated strongly enough to figure out a way how to get money back. I mean, certainly Apple's certainly getting money on their iTunes, and there's other examples of that. I mean, some streaming has been going on and making some money. I mean, satellite radio, is an example of making some money in an unconventional medium, right? Something that we haven't thought about. In the end, unless this can be figured out, the back end, which I guess might become the front end, right, eventually, if we can't figure out ways to make money, it means that writers can't be hired, singers can't be hired, baseball players can't be hired. You know, it really is a crisis when you stop and think about it. In Elusive Fan, we talk about the highlight generation.
Yeah.
You know, ranging from like 1990 on to today, where, you know, if I watched a baseball game, you know, I watched it. If I watched a game on television 20 years ago, I sat down, watched all 9 innings generally, and someone said to me, "Did you see the game?" I said, "Yeah, I did. You know, Baltimore beat Minnesota 2-1. Today, someone says, "Did you see the game?" Someone says, "Yeah. What happened?" "Oh, Baltimore beat Minnesota 2-1. If you ask the second question, "How much of the game did you see?" they might say, "I saw it on the highlights, right? I saw 30 seconds of it, right?" I mean, it's a different perspective. I mean, to say I see something as opposed to what it used to mean is completely different. And that is, you know, that's an issue for all of us trying to reach anybody. That's an issue for a shopping mall person.
My question is, where do you think this is going to go? Do you have any idea of how this is going to all shake out? Is it going to be like the car industry where there was consolidation? And
yeah, I think what you're going to see is consolidation. I think you're going to see some bigger players ultimately dominating some of the pipelines that have been, you know, operated by people who are doing very well. But then you're going to see a lot of boutiques, smaller operations that are very segmented. Because after all, that's a major, major force. I don't think we can go back to the days where you had 3 networks and everybody listened or watched those networks. So I think people are going to demand specialization, but I don't think it's going to be as free as it is today. I think the costs are probably going to go up, and I think the end user, us, we're going to pay more money. I think this is going to be the golden age of cheap communication right now.
I think you're right.
Kind of like, you know, the gold rush, where, you know, you can get a lot of stuff cheap. It doesn't take a lot of effort. But I don't think that's the way it's going to be in 10 years, because I don't think the system can function that way.
You ultimately have to make money and make a profit. Yeah.
That's right. Like, for example, writers in Hollywood. I mean, if they can't get money for their products, there won't be any Hollywood writers anymore. I mean, it's just supply and demand. If Major League Baseball players, if the league doesn't attract people who are willing to pay something on the front or the back or the middle end or whatever it is, they're not going to be able to pay their salaries. I don't think the average person gets that point or cares at this point.
They're just happy it's free.
That's right.
Right, right, right. I remember, wow, yeah. Come into the colleges and you can see what's going on with music. You know, I mean, it's very difficult now to convert people who for a number of years were getting the music free to paying for it.
Yeah,
it's happening,
exactly.
But slowly.
Yeah, and that was a case where the technology got way ahead of what the industry was willing to do. The customers wanted it delivered in a certain way, and it took really iTunes and Steve Jobs to figure out a way to do it and get paid for it.
The other issue that now that you mention that I think is really important that we learned in sports, and I think you can draw across all industries in this issue, is that when people are exposed to new technologies that please them and delight them, they expect it at all levels. So, for example, a professional team builds a billion-dollar stadium, and they put in state-of-the-art TVs and all kinds of electronic ramps and quick access to all kinds of other issues of technology. You think, well, how's that going to affect the grade schools and high schools? Is it going to affect them, or are people going to be willing to sit in rickety old stands and watch games? I don't think so. I think that's a real change. I mean, that's where it gets really expensive. We see, for example, in the United States, basically in the high schools, that, you know, the kids who are 15, 16, 17, 18 years of age, we see those teams, the facilities going crazy. Medicine facilities, football stadiums, all of that. Big dollars going into these high schools. because people won't come to games unless they're like the professionals.
We've come a long way from just having night games.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and the other issue is that the high schools now in the United States compete against the college and professional teams for media time.
That's true.
Friday night was historically a place where high schools owned the time. No college or professional team would dare have a game on a Friday night. That's gone. They're on almost every night now. And I'm sure that's going on all over the world.
The various sports are infringing on other sports seasons and times and dates.
Yeah, and technology is driving that, because I know that, you know, they can get there easily, they can stream it easily, there's all kinds of ways to reach that consumer. But, you know, the high schools are competing against all other entertainment factors beside. Video games, right, for example, have taken a tremendous piece of the entertainment business. And for a lot of people, it's hard to understand, but, you know, I was in a place the other night, which was a kind of a video game arcade. I assume they have them out in California.
You bet.
They have like 40 machines that are dedicated to video games.
That's right.
It was like a Tuesday night. You walked in. There's kids at every one of these video screens playing. $5 an hour. Well, you know they're not out playing basketball,
right,
or baseball, or going to a movie. They're sitting there watching those games. So, I mean, sometimes you worry that it's a zero-sum game. It's almost frightening. It was a nice, beautiful night. And there they were in there, you know. It wasn't so great in that place, but they were just ferociously playing those games.
And hence advertisers are starting to look to video games as a way to advertise their products. Because that's where the kids are spending time. My 14-year-old son spends a lot of time down on his Xbox and his computer. So yeah,
a long way from the music, man. What are those kids doing? You know, they're at the pool hall, right?
Yeah.
Right? Talking dirty.
and eating sen-sen.
Yeah, right. It is amazing how these things change, isn't it? But I don't think there's ever been a more challenging generation than this youth market. And I think it's global. I think that trying to reach them and to try to find out what they want to do, and the market changes so quickly, you know, it's so challenging, is a real issue for almost everybody. I mean, I have a son who is a Hollywood situation comedy writer. There's a business that is so challenging because it's kind of a case study of how everything's become fragmented. Not only do viewers change, the pipelines change so much, and how people are now watching 10-minute sitcoms on the internet, which never didn't exist before, all creating competition for the traditional means of communication. And in the United States, you see the erosion of the theater business. You know, it was down, I can't remember exactly whether it was down 8% or whatever, but it's compounding. And if you go back 60, 70 years ago, it's a fraction of what it was back then, which tells you everything you want to know about how technology can, you know, in impact a society.
Right, there's so much choice now.
Yeah.
Well, Irv, we've really appreciated you taking the time to speak with us and to be on this podcast. This has been really amazing and fun. And I really want to highly endorse The Elusive Fan and High Visibility. They're great books, and I think people can really learn about a lot about communication and marketing and have a little fun reading them as well. So thank you, Irv.
Well, thank you both. I really appreciate it talking to you, and say hello and goodbye to your audience.
Thanks for listening to the Cullinane and Green Report. We hope you'll join us again next time. In the meantime, remember, we're on the bleeding edge, so you don't have to be.